Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for March 27th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today headlines. Our first article is entitled, Secretary Hegseth Needs to Resign. Both of Arizona's U.S. senators have now called on Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to resign after he provided details of a looming military strike on Yemeni rebels in an unsecured group chat on Signal. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, who doubted Hegseth was fit to head the Pentagon when he opposed that nomination in January, added his name to the list of Democrats now calling for Hegseth to step down. The Signal incident is what happens when you have the most unqualified Secretary of Defense we've ever seen, Kelly said in a statement on March 26th. We're lucky it didn't cost any service members their lives, but for the safety of our military and our country, Secretary Hegseth needs to resign. His seatmate, Senator Ruben Gallego, Democrat of Arizona, did the same on March 24th, the day news about the chat thread was published. This is ridiculous and dangerous. Hegseth needs to resign. He compromised the security of our men and women. Most importantly, he could have compromised the mission objective, Gallego said. Kelly's assessment comes as Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee grilled Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, in a hearing mirroring a March 25th hearing in the Senate. The controversy started when Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, wrote a story that disclosed he was mistakenly included in the group chat, which outlined the plans for the March 15 attack on Iranian-aligned rebels in Sana'a, Yemen. On March 26th, the magazine published more of the messages that were posted in the group chat. The White House and the National Security Council have acknowledged the Atlantic's messages were genuine, but Hegseth lashed out at Goldberg personally and maintained to reporters nobody was texting war plans. Hegseth sought to downplay the breach in protocol with a March 26th social media post. So, let me set this straight. The Atlantic released the so-called war plans, and those plans include no names, no targets, no locations, no units, no routes, no sources, no methods, and no classified information. Those are really some war plans. This only proves one thing. Jeff Goldberg has never seen a war plan or an attack plan, as he now calls it. Not even close. We will continue to do our job while the media does what it does best, peddle hoaxes. Gallego, who is a Marine combat veteran and was a member of the House Armed Services Committee, quickly responded with a post of his own. You have launch times, weapons, platforms. Your signal chat was called Houthi's PC small group. Any semi-sophisticated enemy could figure out our approaches to the target and compromise the mission. This is a horrible example of our men and women in uniform. To this point, Republicans have offered only muted criticism of the Pentagon for the evident security lapse, suggesting that it was a mistake, but should not cost Hegseth his job. The controversy is a reversal for Republicans, who pressed former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton over sending classified information over unsecured emails during the Obama administration. For his part, President Donald Trump sought to downplay the incident by saying the information was not classified. Now, if it's classified information, it's probably a little bit different, But I always say you have to learn from any experience, he said on March 25th. Mike Waltz, the national security advisor who added Goldberg to the group chat, made arguments similar to Hegseth's that drew support from GOP senators. Foreign partners had already been notified that strikes were imminent, he said. Bottom line, President Trump is protecting America and our interests. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, who is a member of the Armed Services Committee and chairs the Intelligence Committee, responded, I had been notified too. Long overdue action to protect America after years of former President Joe Biden's weakness. During the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, Kelly pressed CIA Director John Ratcliffe about whether discussing forthcoming military operations in an unsecured environment, such as Signal, was appropriate. Pre-decisional strike deliberations should be conducted through classified channels, Ratcliffe said. The chat included information about weapons packages, targets, and timing, and Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio were among those included in it. Kelly, a Navy combat pilot and a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, was wary about Hegseth leading the Pentagon from the time Trump said he would nominate the former Fox News commentator for the post in his second administration. Kelly said Hegseth could not survive scrutiny of his record if placed under oath because of a past that includes public drunkenness, allegation of sexual assault, and poor management decisions. Kelly and Gallego both voted against Hegseth's confirmation. Pete Hegseth doesn't bring the kind of experience that prepares someone to do this massive job, and he was unable to answer direct questions at his hearings concerning personal issues, Kelly said at the time. Gallego was similarly skeptical that Hegseth could effectively head the Pentagon. The stakes could not be higher for the men and women who serve our country and put their lives on the line to secure our freedoms, he said then. Our service members need an experienced leader, especially at a time when America is facing evolving threats from conflict in the Middle East to an increasingly aggressive China. Pete Hegseth is not that leader. Other Democrats have also called for Hegseth's resignation. They include House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York and Senators Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, Mark Warner of Virginia, and Ron Wyden of Oregon. The next article is entitled, Old Town Parking Dispute Fractures Scottsdale Council. Scottsdale Mayor Lisa Borowski stepped onto a political landmine in February when she tried to delay the contract for a parking structure in Old Town. The attempt provoked outcry from those who supported and opposed the project. It isolated the mayor from four conservative council members who shared her ideology and goals. It also severed alliances between activists who campaigned for all five politicians and expected them to vote in lockstep to deliver what many of them refer to as a more resident-friendly government. Borowski's questioning of the parking structure drew scrutiny from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. The office received an informal complaint that came days after an anonymous blog had accused Borowski of potentially violating city ethics and procurement rules in her attempt to delay the contract. The motive? To benefit her friend and campaign donor, David Hovey Jr., a prominent Scottsdale architect, the blog alleged. The county attorney's office wouldn't say who filed the complaint. The finger-pointing commenced. In a letter threatening legal action, the mayor and Hovey Jr. named six people they suspected were behind the tip-off to prosecutors. The letter was bold. It accused sitting and former council members of conspiring to defame the mayor and the architect and demanded they cough up evidence. The letter from attorney Dennis Welinchik also named Ron Pritchett, a local political consultant, as the man behind the anonymous and provocative blog, Scottsdale Edge. With no hard evidence, only speculation, Welinchik cited a local news article quoting anonymous sources and a former council member who claimed it was commonly understood Pritchett was the source. The acrimonious blogging, accusations, and legal threats kept Scottsdale in the spotlight for weeks. Local media dubbed the dispute Parking Gate and reported its every development. Left-leaning political aficionados mocked the city from afar, deriding the infighting as a hilarious spectacle from a council that went full MAGA. As the controversy erupted into public view, accusations and counterclaims whirled, creating a climate of suspicion in City Hall that persists and bleeds into other topics. The county attorney took a couple of weeks to close the review of the mayor, saying there was nothing to pursue. The anonymous blog claimed, "Parking Gate has been put to rest." But the matter was not entirely over. While awkward, yet civil, council meetings continue at Scottsdale City Hall. The mayor and Hovey Jr.'s legal threat remains. Borowski wants answers. So does the public. One question is top of mind. How did it come to this? In November, Borowski beat former Scottsdale Mayor David Ortega in an election that reflected a wave of anti-incumbent sentiment in the city. The council was made new after residents, frustrated over the growth of apartments they viewed as too expensive and invasive to their quality of life, kicked incumbents to the curb and welcomed in a new slate. Anti-development voters were thrilled to elect Jan Dubauskas outright in the July primary election. The excitement continued with Adam Quasman's success 4 months later. But Borowski winning the mayor's seat, which she had lost to Ortega only 4 years early, was the cherry on top. Voters expected the trio to join Barry Graham and Kathy Littlefield as a powerhouse 5-member majority voting bloc. "We walked the neighborhoods for you. We walked them for Barry, and we walked them for Kathy Littlefield. I don't understand why they are not following you, the leader, down the road," one Scottsdale resident would later tell the mayor at a recent community meeting. But after taking office in January, Borowski saw a vote she was scheduled to take and didn't like it. The council was slated to approve a $1.6 million pre-construction contract to expand the Old Town Civic Center parking corral at First Street and Brown Avenue. It would replace the open-air parking lot with a multi-story garage. The vote was scheduled on the council's consent agenda, reserved for non-controversial measures that routinely pass unanimously without discussion. Borowski said she feared the garage would clash with the area's character and farmers market that occupies the space on weekends. She said she spoke to nearby store owners and shoppers who knew nothing about the proposal. Speaking to voters at the Via Linda Senior Center, the mayor noted how her campaign focused on high-quality development and public involvement, two principles she believed the parking structure lacked. She thought the city could and should do better. Borowski moved the vote to the next meeting. Then she set about getting buy-in from council members and longtime Old Town enthusiasts such as French Thompson and Susan Wood for her proposal to delay the contract 30 days. Borowski held two meetings and invited David Hovey Jr. to present renderings of other potential parking structure options. The effort enraged Thompson and even Old Town Gallery owner Bob Pejman, who had supported Borowski's campaign. Thompson, Pejman, and other Old Town diehards had waited years, decades even, for more parking critical to the bars and restaurants that make the area famous. The mayor said she wanted the agreement to be improved or the location changed, but changing the location would have voided the agreement. In the eyes of Pejman and Thompson, voiding the agreement opened the door to delay with an unforeseeable time span. That was non-negotiable. Even the prospect of delay, for them, was an inconceivable effort to thwart the decades-long dispute, the resolution of which was finally nearing the finish line. Thompson rebuked Borowski at the February 11th meeting in which she tried to delay the vote. He told the Arizona Republic that while he was initially open to Borowski's suggestions for contract improvements, he grew suspicious when he realized relocation was on the table. He came to believe the effort was a conspiracy to cancel the contract and rebid the project out to Hovey Jr. The battle over where to build an Old Town parking garage was hard fought and explains the furor in response to Borowski's request for delay. Scottsdale voters approved $21 million in bond funding by overwhelming margins in 2019 to build more parking. It came after a 2015 study showed 85% of Old Town's 16,400 parking spots were taken up during the daytime. The area was an effective shortage of spots, the study said. Old Town merchants claimed more daytime parking was critical to address their customers' needs. City officials, including former city manager Jim Thompson and then police chief Jeff Walther, now the city's interim assistant city manager, described the need as absolutely essential. City staffers suggested three locations south of Indian School Road, including the parking corral, but did not commit to specific sites in 2019. But after the election, city officials found that two of the locations proved infeasible, leaving only the parking corral. Former Public Works Director Dan Wirth said the city struggled to find workable alternatives, preventing the project from getting off the ground. In April, Wirth presented new options, the parking corral and two locations north of Indian School Road. That's where parking has become the worst in the city, but it's far away from the more southern locations that originally were presented to voters. The options sparked a conflict between property owners in North and South Old Town about whether the change was dishonest because it was different from the original site suggestions, or if it made the most sense because of how the parking situation had changed. Former council member Tammy Caputi adamantly opposed the corral expansion, calling it a waste of money. She suggested the city cut that option, which would keep the overall parking project under budget. Scottsdale's 2019 bond program, which in total was $319 million to fund about 60 projects citywide, has frequently gone over budget. Caputi wasn't alone. Former Councilman Tom Durham agreed, saying voters would be more upset if they learned we were going to use those bond funds on a garage that's going to be empty 95% of the time, he said, referring to the San Francisco Giants' 15-game spring training schedule that takes place near the corral. About 350 small business owners in Old Town agreed with Caputi and Durham. They signed a petition asking the city to build the new parking structure in northeast Old Town, where the 2015 parking study shows the biggest deficit of parking anywhere downtown. Then-Mayor Ortega and Councilwoman Solange Littlefield also opposed the corral expansion, largely for aesthetic reasons. Ortega suggested the city work with Honor Health to see if parking could be built on any of its parcels in Old Town, but Worth said the city had met with the company and it didn't appear to be viable. But council members Barry Graham, Kathy Littlefield, and Betty Janik argued voters expected the parking locations to be south of Indian School Road during the bond 2019 election. The ballot measure didn't specifically say that, but promotional material for the bond did. Thompson, Pejman, and Marilyn Atkinson, another Old Town merchant of some 60 years, pleaded for the corral expansion at multiple meetings. They talked about their customers who repeatedly complained about parking and reminded the city that the Civic Center expansion with all of its events brought additional parking demands. These parking garages affect people's livelihood, Thompson said. Please stop procrastinating. It's something that's been voted on, so please get it done. If you build it, they'll come. Pejman said it would be a slap in the face of the voters if the city didn't expand the corral. After months of fierce debate, the council split the baby and opted for two garages instead of one, a resolution to a conflict that otherwise showed no end in sight. A collective sigh of relief washed over City Hall until Borowski opened the can of worms at the start of the new year. Asserting the same concerns and resolutions as her predecessors, such as working with Honor Health, Borowski's comments threw Corral's parking supporters into a tailspin. After the mayor failed to secure a contract delay at the February 11th meeting, the anonymous blog Scottsdale Edge claimed the county attorney was investigating her for potentially violating the city's ethics and procurement process. The blog cited no sources and did not explain how it came across the information. The claim was misleading, but a kernel of truth in it mystified Borowski. Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell's office was, in fact, looking into the mayor. But more accurately, the office was looking into a complaint about the mayor. It wasn't technically an investigation because the complaint wasn't filed by police, meaning it was considered unverified and informal. Before the county attorney could investigate Borowski, she needed to determine if the concerns were even credible. Borowski, who vehemently denied misconduct, set her sights on finding who filed the complaint. She called reporters to question what they knew, but the county attorney hadn't disclosed the source. Graham and Quasman, the mayor's purported allies on the council, didn't come to her defense. Dubauskas added to the criticism, disputing the mayor's recollection of internal meetings. Anytime a donor is brought into a meeting to discuss their area of expertise and they are offering expertise, I think we should all be concerned, Dubauskas told the Republic. Susan Wood, a supporter of the mayor, said the other council members had a vendetta against her and criticized them for not coming to Dabrowski's defense. Another voter was shocked the council hadn't supported Borowski's delay from the start. "I thought our four were going to be yes, 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 yes," the woman said at the Via Linda meeting. And out of nowhere, it seemed, it was no, 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 no. The mayor figured it had to be someone who attended her meeting about the parking structure, putting Dabauskas and Thompson in the hot seat. Borowski also began to suspect Kathy and Bob Littlefield, since Bob, a former Scottsdale councilman, bashed the mayor in the Scottsdale Progress, a local news outlet. "Maybe he was bitter she beat him in the primary for mayor in 2020, Borowski suggested at a Via Linda community meeting. Borowski told the Republic she believed other elected officials were using anonymous blogs as their lobbying effort. At her State of the City address in late February, she expressed concern over the blogs and suggested they shouldn't be trusted. By mid-March, Willinchek sent a letter on behalf of Borowski and Hovey threatening legal action to Dabauskas, both Littlefields, Thompson, Pejman, and Pritchett. The mayor's eroding faith in her colleagues paved way for skepticism on other issues, too. At her State of the City, Borowski announced she would work to establish a volunteer fire brigade to mitigate wildfire risk. Days before a news conference about the effort, the mayor told residents at the Via Linda Center that the city manager had called it off. Borowski believed her council colleagues were to blame and submitted a records request for communication between Dabauskas, Graham, and several city officials to get to the bottom of it, an almost unheard-of gambit. The records mostly validated Borowski's hunch, but they also showed signs of discomfort among city staff. After the news release was sent around internally, Dabauskas emailed acting city manager Greg Catone. "This is a terrible idea. Surprised you went along with it." Fire Chief Tom Shannon emailed Caton the next day asking if he should send a clarification email to the council to hopefully cool things down, as I've gotten emails and phone texts from council members on this. Caton told Dabauskas, "This idea took on a life of its own this week and got ahead of what the chief and I initially agreed to. We were working with the mayor's office to recalibrate." Shannon said he was very supportive of the mayor's idea to expand volunteer opportunities, but he also pumped the brakes with Terrence Thornton, the mayor's chief of staff, over a draft news release about the mayor's proposal and her plans to explain them at a news conference. "Terrence, please do not put this out before we discuss fully and with the city manager's input and involvement," Shannon wrote. Thornton replied, "Of course, our plans are to do this in concert with you. We will cool our heels and let's chat tomorrow." The week after the debacle, the county attorney announced that the review into Borowski was closed. An investigation wouldn't be launched because there was nothing to pursue, said Janine LeCourier, Mitchell's chief of staff for communications. Willinchek said the decision out of Mitchell's office strengthened the mayor and Hovey Jr.'s case. He believes the complaint was filed with the express intent of tipping off news outlets to hurt the mayor. He said he plans to get to the bottom of who submitted it. Parking Gate isn't going away. You're listening to Hour One of today's Arizona Republic on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article entitled "GOP Targets Arizona's Summer Gas Law," written by Stacy Bartschenger. Arizona Republicans are renewing an effort to loosen a unique-to-the-state requirement to use special gasoline in the summer to reduce pollution. And this time, they say they have the Trump administration on their side. That could be key, as the changes outlined by House Bill 2300 would need approval of the Federal Environmental Protection Agency if they first clear the legislature and win the signature of Arizona's Democratic governor. The vast changes proposed by the bill face other hurdles, including the fact that they would take years to go into effect and might not achieve the goal of lowering gas prices, according to testimony before a Senate committee on March 25th. Still, GOP lawmakers say Arizonans are feeling the pain at the pump, and the bill offers economic relief and prevents future price spikes. The amended bill from Senator T.J. Thope, Republican of Coolidge, expands the types of approved gas blends allowed in Maricopa County, allows anyone to request the state seek a waiver of summer fuel requirements, and requires legislative leadership be notified if those requests are made. For weeks in March 2023, prices in Phoenix topped $5 per gallon, more than some of the nation's most expensive gas markets. The Phoenix area was hit because two of the refineries that produce Arizona's unique cleaner burning gasoline, or CBG, were out of service. The other refineries that produce CBG could not get fuel to the state to make up the shortfall. The state can seek a waiver of those CBG requirements, but only in certain circumstances. Under the authority of the Clean Air Act, the EPA sets standards in tandem with states in places like Phoenix that have high air pollution. The Arizona legislature in 1997 approved the use of CBG to target pollution, establishing different fuel blends in the summer and winter. GOP lawmakers attacked Governor Katie Hobbs, a Democrat, after the Arizona Republic reported Hobbs did not seek a waiver when she knew there would be shortages that would drive price increases in 2023. In response, the bill backed by Shope this year includes requirements that the Senate President and Speaker of the House be notified of waiver requests. Those notifications make sure the legislature is looped in during these shortage situations right from the start, so we can advocate for Arizona at the federal level when Hobbs will not, Shope said in a statement. Those notifications and any communications about them would also be kept confidential and exempt from public disclosure, according to a summary of the bill. Shope said that is because confidentiality is allowed by an existing state law for the gasoline industry and was important to prevent runs on gasoline if concerns about shortages become publicly known. Last year, Hobbs did seek waivers in the summer months as several legislative proposals were introduced to make more types of gasoline available. Those bills, which a Hobbs spokesperson called half-baked, never made it out of the legislature. Senate President Warren Peterson, Republican of Gilbert, said in a statement that he met with EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin 2 weeks ago and raised concerns that the requirements are unfair because some of the pollution travels to the Phoenix area. Zeldin visited the state in March and met with several political and tribal leaders, including U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, and Hobbs. House Bill 2300 is the first step in removing the shackles off Arizona and positions us to reduce gas prices quickly in coordination with upcoming action from Administrator Zeldin on behalf of the Trump administration, Peterson said in a statement. Providing multiple fuel options allows the market to compete during unexpected shortages and will help keep gas prices low for Arizona drivers. Zeldin said in March the EPA would work with states as part of Trump's deregulation agenda, and the EPA said in a statement it would work with Arizona to find a common-sense path to cleaner air in a way that allows Phoenix to also continue its economic growth. Democrats on the Arizona Senate's Natural Resources and Energy Committee weren't on board with the GOP's plans. The committee's 4-3 vote to advance the bill was split along party lines, with Republicans in favor. This bill weakens Arizona's clean air protections, said Senator Rosanna Gabaldon, Democrat of Green Valley. It selects gas companies over public health. Arizona needs cleaner air and sustainable energy solutions, not rollbacks of environmental protections. Gabaldon asked Jody Mueller, chief operating officer of the Western States Petroleum Association, if allowing more types of gasoline would lead to lower prices. The association represents refineries and pipelines. Not necessarily, Mueller said. The gasoline markets are pure economics, supply and demand. It will depend on the supply. There are so many factors going into that supply, especially in a market like Arizona, where you do not have in-state productions. I could not say yes or no to that question. There are many factors that impact it. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article entitled, Legislature Floats a New Bill to Keep Axon in the State, written by Karina Vanek. Taser maker Axon has taken another run at the legislature to secure its future in Arizona, this time an attempt to loosen zoning restrictions surrounding international corporate headquarters. A new bill would grant developers the right to build apartments and hotels on land zoned for light industrial if they are part of a company's international headquarters. The loosened zoning restriction would be tied to certain requirements, including the size of the city where the project is built, salaries of employees, and percentage of housing units reserved for employees. The bill was created as a strike everything amendment, which deletes the original contents of a bill and replaces it with something entirely new. In this case, the proposed legislation, now called SB 1543, replaces a bill regarding homestead exemptions that was proposed by Sun City West Republican Senator Frank Carroll. The Arizona House of Representatives International Trade Committee was set to discuss the bill on March 26th. Axon has been embattled over plans to develop an expanded global headquarters in Scottsdale for months. It received intense opposition to its proposal from neighbors and from Worker Power Institute. The political arm of the Unite Here Local 11 labor union. The company received approval from the Scottsdale City Council in late 2024 to change the zoning on its roughly 73-acre site to allow the headquarters building, along with apartments, condominiums, a hotel, and restaurants. A group called Taxpayers Against Awful Apartment Zoning Exemptions, or TAZE, which received support from Worker Power, according to financial disclosures filed with the city, collected signatures to force a referendum vote over the approval of the project. Axon executives have repeatedly said they cannot wait for the outcome of the vote and may be forced to move the company to another state, likely Texas or Florida. Axon leaders heralded the proposed legislation as a solution that could have across-the-aisle support and could benefit Arizona's economic development landscape by creating flexibility and options for corporate headquarters. This does help, but it has always been the case that we are trying to help the Arizona economy, Charles Huell Mendel, the zoning attorney representing Axon, said. If passed, the bill would allow apartments and hotels as an ancillary use to the corporate headquarters development in a light industrial zone, provided that key targets are met. Those targets include the development must be in a city larger than 200,000 residents, but smaller than 500,000. Cities that qualify include Chandler, Gilbert, Glendale, and Scottsdale. Peoria's population was just under 200,000 in 2023, according to U.S. Census data, and would likely also qualify now. The corporate headquarters must employ more than 2,000 full-time employees at an annual compensation of more than 125% of the median wage of the country. The ancillary apartment and hotel buildings must be part of an international headquarters campus. At least 20% of the apartment units must be used by employees at the headquarters building. However, there is a provision in the bill that the city could modify that occupancy requirement. The units cannot be used for rentals in periods shorter than 90 days. The new allowed developments would be governed generally by the size of the site, which would determine the number of housing units and hotel rooms. The number of allowed housing units would be equal to or more than the number of gross acres on the headquarters campus multiplied by 28. In Axon's case, for a 73-acre campus, that would mean the allowed residential units would be at least 2,044. The number of hotel rooms allowed would be equal to or more than the acreage of the campus multiplied by 7. In Axon's case, the allowed hotel rooms would be at least 511. Up to 10% of the hotel rooms could be offered as for-sale residence. The city could limit height of a hotel or apartment on the campus to 2 stories if it is immediately adjacent or within 100 feet of an area zoned for single-family homes. If it's not within 100 feet of single-family homes, the city cannot restrict building heights to less than 6 stories. The bill is a departure from another legislative attempt to secure the company's future in Arizona. An earlier bill that was introduced aimed to reclassify zoning changes as administrative decisions by city councils rather than legislative decisions. Administrative decisions are not subject to referendum. That bill has appeared to stall in the state legislature and has not had any new hearings in more than a month. Huell Mendel said Axon is interested in furthering any legislation that would allow the company to stay in Arizona, but said the latest approach, The flexibility in zoning for corporate headquarters seems to have been the more acceptable solution in discussion with lawmakers. Arizona is still in dire need for housing, Will Mantell said, and this proposal would allow large job creators to also add housing to their projects. Even our harshest critics are saying they want Axon here, but the argument is they don't want the apartments, a company CEO Rick Smith said. You can't bring jobs here and not have a place for people to live. Smith said the Axon Board of Directors has given a deadline of the end of this legislative session to make the decision on whether to stay in Arizona or move. If the bill is passed into law and Axon is able to move forward with its project, Smith said he expects construction activity to begin within about 3 months from the effective date of the law. Axon would still need to secure the needed permits and secure contracts from construction companies, he said. The leader of the Taze Group said the change in Axon's approach came when it was clear the other bill, which would quash any referenda over zoning, was too unpopular. It's outrageous, of course, Bob Littlefield, a former Scottsdale City Councilman who has been leading Taze, said. It's clearly special interest legislation designed to benefit Axon at the expense of Scottsdale voters. Littlefield said the new proposal was a little more subtle than the attempted overall ban on zoning referenda, but said it still ignores the wills of citizens who signed the petition to get the measure on a future ballot. They maybe put a little lipstick on it, but it's still a pig, he said. The bill doesn't address what would happen to the referendum that has already been qualified for the ballot, Littlefield said, leaving ambiguity about what the future of the development would look like. But, he said, the heart of the issue, the area's opposition to the development, particularly the apartments, remains unchanged. We will fight it to the bitter end, Littlefield said. Our next article is entitled, Trump Presses Ahead with Auto Tariff Plans, written by Nandita Bose, David Lauder, and David Shepherdson. President Trump on Wednesday unveiled a 25% tariff on imported cars and light trucks starting next week, widening the global trade war he kicked off upon regaining the White House this year, and in a move auto industry experts expect will drive up prices and stymie production. What we're going to be doing is a 25% tariff on all cars that are not made in the United States, Trump said at an event in the Oval Office. Trump, who sees tariffs as a tool to raise revenue to offset his promised tax cuts and to revive a long declining U.S. industrial base, said collections would begin on April 3rd, the day after he plans to announce reciprocal tariffs aimed at the countries responsible for the bulk of the U.S. trade deficit. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen described the move as bad for business, worse for consumers, while Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney labeled it as a direct attack on Canadian workers. We will defend our workers, we will defend our companies, we will defend our country, and we will defend it together, Carney told reporters in Ottawa. The United Auto Workers, long-standing critics of free trade agreements it says have destroyed American jobs, lauded it. These tariffs are a major step in the right direction for auto workers and blue-collar communities across the country, and it is now on the automakers, from the Big Three to Volkswagen and beyond, to bring back good union jobs to the U.S., UAW President Sean Fain said in a statement. Shares of automakers fell in after-hours trading, and U.S. equity index futures slid, indicating stocks were headed for a lower open on Thursday. The legal basis for the action is a 2019 national security investigation under Section 232 of the Trade Act of 1962 into auto imports that Trump's first administration conducted. That probe found that auto imports impair U.S. national security, but at the time, Trump did not take action to impose tariffs. In an indication of the hastiness with which the new levies are being imposed, Trump's directive included temporary exemptions for auto parts while government officials sort through the complexities of turning his proclamation into practice. It exempts, for now, for instance, auto parts that are compliant with the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement on Trade that Trump negotiated during his first term. The agreement allows for largely duty-free trade between the U.S. and its two largest trading partners. USMCA-compliant automobile parts must remain tariff-free until the Secretary of Commerce, in consultation with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, establishes a process to apply tariffs to their non-U.S. content, White House Principal Deputy Secretary Harrison Fields said on X. It further exempts until May 3rd all other auto parts imports. The U.S. imported $474 billion worth of automotive products in 2024, including passenger cars worth $220 billion. Mexico, Japan, South Korea, Canada, and Germany, all close U.S. allies, were the biggest suppliers. Ahead of Trump's announcement, shares of U.S.-listed automakers fell on concerns that tariffs could send shockwaves through the global auto industry that is already reeling from uncertainty caused by Trump's rapid-fire tariff threats and occasional reversals. The U.S. stock market also closed lower on worries over tariffs, which have dogged investors for much of the last month. The benchmark S&P 500 index fell 1.1% ahead of the news conference and is down more than 4% so far in March for its worst monthly performance in nearly a year. Since taking office on January 20th, Trump has announced and delayed tariffs on Canada and Mexico for what he alleges is their role in allowing the opioid fentanyl into the U.S., set import taxes on goods from China for the same reason, launched hefty duties on imports of steel and aluminum, and has repeatedly touted his plans to announce global reciprocal tariffs on April 2nd. Regarding the coming April 2nd announcement, Trump indicated the measures may not be the like-for-like levies he has pledged in the past. "We're going to make it very lenient," Trump said. "I think people will be very surprised. It'll be, in many cases, less than the tariff they've been charging the U.S. for decades." The new vehicle levies are expected to drive costs of cars higher for consumers by thousands of dollars, hitting new vehicle sales and resulting in job losses, since the U.S. auto industry relies heavily on imported parts, according to the Center for Automotive Research. At a time when cost is the number one concern for American car buyers, U.S. automakers are working to provide a range of affordable vehicles for consumers, Jennifer Safarian, president and CEO of Autos Drive America, a trade group representing foreign automakers, said in a statement. The tariffs imposed today will make it more expensive to produce and sell cars in the United States, ultimately leading to higher prices, fewer options for consumers, and fewer manufacturing jobs in the U.S. The next article is entitled, Truce Agreements Run into Trouble Within Hours. Ukraine and Russia accused one another of Wednesday on flouting a truce on energy strikes brokered by the United States, and the European Union said it would not meet conditions set by Russia for a planned ceasefire in the Black Sea. The United States announced separate agreements with Ukraine and Russia on Tuesday to pause their strikes in the Black Sea and against each other's energy targets, but the rhetoric from Moscow and Kyiv suggested they remained far apart. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the U.S. side told Kyiv the deals were effective as soon as they were announced. But the Kremlin said the Black Sea Agreement would not enter force until a sanctioned Russian state bank was reconnected to the international payment system. Europe said that would not happen until a Russian withdrawal from Ukraine. The Kremlin contends it has already been implementing a pause on energy attacks since March 18th, though a senior Ukrainian presidential official said Russia had attacked 8 Ukrainian energy facilities since that date. On paper, the agreements are a tangible step toward a ceasefire after Russia launched its invasion in February 2022, unleashing the biggest conflict in Europe since World War II that still rages on along a 600-mile front line. Led by President Donald Trump, who wants a quick peace, the United States on Tuesday published two separate joint statements with Moscow and Kyiv outlining the deals, but neither document set out a clear timeline for their implementation. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.